Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam, Bucharest, 2, 1.
She was the people's princess, and that's how she will stay, how she will remain in our hearts and in our memories forever.
I admired and respected her for her energy and commitment to others.
It is a point to remember that of all the ironies about Diana, perhaps the greatest was this. A girl given the name of the ancient goddess of hunting was, in the end, the most hunted person of the modern age.
It's been 10 years since Diana, Princess of Wales, died in a car crash in Paris. Whether she was dodging the paparazzi or being the subject of a racy headline, Diana was rarely out of the media spotlight. So on today's Network Europe, we'll take an in-depth look at tabloid press across the continent.
I think that they have a big power over people because they'll often scandalize stories and make things seem worse than they actually are.
They're entertaining, I mean, especially if you just don't have much time to read a long story or anything like that. They're fun to read. The crime stories and I suppose the sexual scandal stories, all that stuff. It's actually pretty fun.
I think they're trash, but I can't help reading them. They're a bit like lollies or chocolate. You shouldn't have them, but you have to have a nibble every now and again.
All things tabloid, plus the winners of our latest quiz coming up on Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's international broadcasters. I'm Barbara Gruber.
I understood the media might be interested in what I did. I realized then their attention would inevitably focus on both our private and public lives. But I was not aware of how overwhelming that attention would become, nor the extent to which it would affect both my public duties and my personal life.
Diana, Princess of Wales, commenting on the insatiable appetite of the media in her public and private life. It's now 10 years since Diana's death in a high-speed car crash in Paris, which also claimed the lives of Dodi Al-Fayed and the driver Henri Paul. What role did the Paris paparazzi and indeed the media play in the accident? This week, Phil Hall, then editor of News of the World, admitted the media had some responsibility for her death. He said, if the paparazzi hadn't been following her, the car wouldn't have been speeding, and the accident may never have happened. A big Diana story could add 150,000 sales, so we were all responsible. 10 years after Diana's death, the media interest in the People's Princess has not diminished, as Radio Netherlands' Richard Walker reports.
Goodbye, England's Road.
Being a consumer of the news yourself, you'd be hard-pressed to avoid the 10-year anniversary of Diana's death in a week where few of the world's media organs will fail to mention it. There's no doubting Diana's enduring appeal. There was something about her that generated enough public interest to render her the world's most famous woman by a long way. When she died, the media went into a frenzy of self-reflection. Had the media itself, in the form of paparazzi on scooters chasing Diana's Mercedes through Paris, ultimately killed her? Her brother, Earl Spencer, certainly thought so.
She talked endlessly of getting away from England, mainly because of the treatment that she received at the hands of the newspapers. I don't think she ever understood why her genuinely good intentions were sneered at by the media, why there appeared to be a permanent quest on their behalf to bring her down. It is baffling. My own and only explanation is that genuine goodness is threatening to those at the opposite end of the moral spectrum. It is a point to remember that of all the ironies about Diana, perhaps the greatest was this. A girl given the name of the ancient goddess of hunting was, in the end, the most hunted person of the modern age. She would want us today to pledge ourselves to protecting her beloved boys, William and Harry, from a similar fate. And I do this here, Diana, on your behalf.
Princess Diana's brother, Earl Spencer, speaking at her funeral 10 years ago. But there are some uncomfortable facts about Diana's relationship with the tabloid media that don't sit easily with the idea of her as its victim. Lily Williams was a researcher on Andrew Morton's second book on Diana and has interviewed many of the people close to the princess. I asked her if she agreed with those critics who say Diana manipulated the media.
She definitely did. I mean, Diana did manipulate the media. She did play that game. But I think that it came from the fact that she felt that others were doing that to her. You know, others were manipulating the media against her. It's something that she felt very strongly. Rightly or wrongly, she had a sort of persecution complex, if you like. She definitely felt that the forces that either the palace or her husband or the public or the newspapers were sort of against her at lots of times during her life, and that people were briefing against her. And so I think she felt that she needed to counteract that. And I think that the sad thing is, I feel that she thought that she could do that. But actually, I think if you play that game, if you play with the media and if you decide to manipulate it, then it's something that you can't stop. It's an all or nothing game.
Is it a bit rich for her to, and her family, to claim that she was a victim of the media in the end?
I think that all the stories of saying the media had blood on their hands and things, I mean, I'm not really convinced that it was their fault, really. But I think that papers do pay a lot for photos of her, as I'm sure they pay a lot for photos now of Princes William and Harry.
Last weekend, Jermaine Greer described Diana as a devious moron for sleeping with married men. Do you think Miss Greer was courting media attention for herself by saying that, or do you agree that Diana was a devious moron?
I really think that a lot of people comment on Princess Diana's life. And I mean, including me right now, but I don't want to sound like I'm purely sort of 100% think she was amazing. And I'm sure she did make mistakes, and sleeping with married men is, you know, not a great idea. And as a member of the sisterhood, I wouldn't condone it. But I think that, you know, let he who is without sin cast the first stone. And I wonder if Jermaine Greer looked into her past and her life, whether she's always acted with impunity.
It seems you may have some doubts about the royal family's intentions to protect William and Harry from media attention. Are you sceptical about the royal family's manipulation of the media and their motivations?
I think that they definitely have manipulated the press in the past. Certainly they have. I do think that a legacy, if you like, of Diana is that there is a bit more protection for the boys. They do have a bigger team around them than she did. And also I think there is more discussion now about whether it's right to hound Kate Middleton or things like that, which probably wouldn't have got discussed prior to Diana, really.
You interviewed a lot of people who knew Diana in your work as a researcher for Andrew Morton. What's your impression of how they appear in the tabloid press in relation to Diana?
I think a lot of them are under the mistaken impression that putting her side of the story in the media is going to really help her and was going to, you know, put her side of the story against all these people who were slagging her off. And I just think that, as I said before, you know, if you play the game of the media, you're never going to win, really. And the other thing is that a lot of people do talk about her unnamed in the papers. And actually, the ones who use their names in a way are being more honest, because at least they're admitting that they're there talking about her and being paid to do so often. I mean, also, if you look at the wages that the royal family paid, when I was talking to a lot of the people that used to work for her and other members of the royal family, something that struck me was how appallingly badly paid they were. And, you know, often their jobs were 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So, you know, is it wrong that they should sell their story for a few hundred pounds?
Are they the ones to blame, though? But
I think the people to blame, I mean, I know it's easy to say, are the people like myself, I must say, who buy the tabloids. It's ultimately our thirsts, or supposed thirst, for those stories, which fuels the trade. I presume it must be, because the papers are doing it in order to sell papers.
Richard Walker with his tribute to the Princess of Wales. Well, Diana was, of course, a dream come true for the tabloid press in Britain. More so than anyone else in the British royal family, the life of Diana generated endless public interest. Now, Sweden also has a monarch, King Carl Gustav, but it's quite a different story there. The Swedish royal family is not the scandal-ridden House of Windsor, and the Swedish media has a very different relationship with its royals. Radio Sweden's Mark Cummins explains why it's so different.
I think probably at the basis of it all is the Swedish journalistic code of ethics, which is a self-regulating document that is something that press or all media here adhere to. While that in itself is not particularly unique, something that underpins it all is the Swedish laws concerning freedom of information, which is actually enshrined in the Constitution. And that means that the press and media have access to just about everything that could be called an official document. This starts from things such as court documents. It goes all the way through until the Prime Minister's letters, letters that are addressed to the Prime Minister of Sweden are able to be read by anyone, not just journalists, but anyone who wishes to. So that sort of freedom of information is so overwhelming. Media in Sweden considers this rightly, that it's a wonderful resource that's there and a privilege to have this, so that people actually don't want to rock the boat, I guess, and that's why the self-regulating system works.
You say they don't want to rock the boat, and yet there is a lot of interest in the Swedish royals. Has there been a change in attitudes, let's say, over the past decade?
I think what we see today and what's probably been happening over the past, say, 10 years especially, is that there is a fascination with celebrity in general, and the royals are probably being treated more as celebrities than, say, other public figures, where you wouldn't talk about the girlfriend or the boyfriend of a parliamentarian or the prime minister, etc. You do tend to get that sort of coverage about the royals here. And so I guess in that sense, they're put very much into the celebrity box, and they're treated that way in tabloids and magazines. The difference, though, is that I personally have never seen or read an interview where that sort of question about relationships, boyfriends, girlfriends, is put directly to any of the royal family, or if it is, it's put in a very roundabout way. So that sort of thing, I think when it comes into direct contact and interviews with them, there is a sort of deference that you will see here. And I guess it's a sign of respect that Swedish media feel that they have to show. And at the same time, I think that's probably what the general public feels about the royals, in that there is a huge support for the royals. And in some sense, people think that they should have their private lives as well.
You're saying that there is a lot of respect for the royal family, and yet aren't Swedes curious if the king or queen have affairs on the side, for example?
Yes, I think they are. I think, though, that it would go into the realm of bad taste to have an article about that. There was some speculation a couple of years ago where it was loosely spoken about that the king was had some kind of liaison with a media personality, and that caused a minor stir. It died very quickly because it would seem to be in very bad taste that this sort of thing would be talked about at all in public. So it's quite different there when it comes to those sorts of scandals that in other countries would be leapt upon by the press and made something into something very, very huge. Here they tend to be quietened down very quickly. It can go on, of course, even with other public persons. If there's a divorce or if there's some other family concern, it can be mentioned, but it will usually not be made into a huge story. So that's something that I have seen that works quite differently in Sweden compared to other countries.
But the Swedish royals are popular beyond Sweden's borders. For example, in Germany, there's a lot of interest for them. Are they facing pushy foreign paparazzis?
No, not at all. You don't see that sort of thing. In fact, many times I've seen the royals in the city, usually in their cars, if they're driving around. You'll suddenly look in the rear vision mirror of your car and you'll see it's the king behind you. That sort of thing is not...
driving himself?
It happens... driving himself. That sort of thing happens in Sweden, and that's something that I had to get used to when I first moved here. But it's something that I know that, of course, the three royal children famously went to normal, everyday suburban schools in a part of Stockholm. So the Swedish royal family is very open, and the open nature of Sweden's society is something that everyone values, and I think for that reason, a lot of people don't want to abuse that in any way. And so if you see a famous person, or if you see a royal, perhaps, you wouldn't make as big a thing out of it as perhaps people do in other countries.
But, Mac, do Swedish tabloids cover all the juicy stories coming out of the UK? Do they, for example, publish all the dirt that is being dug up on Diana?
Yes. I think one of the perhaps strange features of Swedish journalism or Swedish tabloid journalism is that they will take stories from other tabloids outside of the country. So you'll often see headlines that are quite shocking, but they're actually talking about someone in the US or someone in the UK or someone in Germany. So it's not until you start reading that you realize it has very little to do with Sweden. But those sort of juicy details, so-called juicy details, pop up in the tabloids all the time. And, of course, with the anniversary of Diana, she's very much in the headlines, very much in the tabloids again.
Radio Sweden's Mark Cummins on the line there from Stockholm. Celebrity gossip, big brash headlines, paparazzi pictures and lots of nudes. Those are all trademarks of British tabloids. But another recurring topic the tabloids love to hate is the European Union, or the so-called Euromyth. You might say Brussels bunkum if you're British. Anthony Gooch is the head of the media at the representation of the European Commission in London, and his mission is to fight these so-called Euromyth.
Well, here in London, we're probably blessed by the fact that we have some of the most creative people in terms of dreaming up the sorts of things that they think that the European Union is responsible for doing. But in all cases, fortunately, we don't actually indulge in. But some of the classics involve the so-called bent banana, the curved banana, where at one stage, certain sections of the British media made out that if a banana was too curved, it would be banned or it would not be able to be sold. This was obviously not true. What we did have to do was to classify between different types of bananas. Another example was that we were involved in somehow establishing the dimensions of condoms that could be used throughout the European Union. Again, something that we have not been involved in and never have been and never will be involved in. One of my favourites involves an allegation that the European Union had called on farmers throughout the European Union and in Britain to provide toys for pigs. In fact, what we had done was to establish European rules whereby where pigs were found or housed, they should be able to have access to straw, hay, compost, things of that nature. That was interpreted by some people as you have to provide a wonderful environment for pigs, including wonderful music and toys and all sorts of things like that. So as you can see, we're not short of these sorts of examples. The imagination and creativity, as you can see, knows no bounds, but it is a source of enjoyment and merriment that we take with a pinch of salt.
We can all see, I think, the funny side of those Euromyths, but how much damage do you think these Euromyths have for the image of the European Union?
Although people do sometimes think of some of these things when they think of the European Union, I think that people are able to distinguish between what sometimes is a little bit of fun, joking and humour, and that's very much part of the British way of life, to make fun of things as much as you can and make fun of governments, politicians, etc., as much as you can. So I think it is legitimate in that sense that we are a bit of a butt for British humour. As far as how damaging these sorts of things are, I would say that now that has diminished quite significantly. I think that, firstly, there are a lot less of these things that crop up. And when they crop up, we're obviously on hand to nail the myths so that they don't actually stay in the public consciousness. We're obviously mindful of the need to correct misperceptions. And so that's very much part of what we do here in London. And obviously, we're also concerned that from Brussels, when we are communicating and when we are presenting what we're doing, that we make sure that we present it in as unambiguous a way as possible so that people who may be tempted to interpret it in a slightly naughty way won't have the opportunity to do it.
Do the tabloids give you the space to put the facts straight?
We are very persistent with them, and we are often very successful in getting across our point of view. It requires a little bit of effort, but very often it's the case. And when it isn't the case, what we've done is on our website, we've created a very popular part of the website, which is What the Papers Do Not Say, where we publish all the letters that we write to newspapers that they don't publish. And so that is a way of putting the record straight in the public domain, but also showing up newspapers sometimes that refuse to set that record straight. So it's a way of naming and shaming a little bit as well, and that's rather effective.
Why is it mostly British tabloids jumping on this Euromyth?
I don't know that it is anymore, to be honest with you. I think in the same way that a certain amount of scepticism about the European Union has extended throughout the European Union in the last 10, 15 years, I don't think this is an exclusively British thing. I think it was certainly probably something that was felt more prominently in the United Kingdom because of the nature of the tabloid press that has a certain style to it, and the fact that traditionally in the United Kingdom it was quite popular to bash the European Union. But I think that now it's often the case that our most significant problems no longer lie in the United Kingdom, but actually in other countries of the European Union, where either there wasn't really a tradition of Euroscepticism, or indeed some of the newer members of the European Union, where political and economic contexts are such that people at times may have felt the EU to be a convenient target for disaffection. So I think probably this is no longer a British problem, and in part I think we may have gone some way to resolving the British problem, but it has extended to other places, which makes our life a little bit more difficult.
Anthony Good from the European Commission in London. You're listening to Network Europe with a special focus on European tabloids. Britain, no doubt, is the hotspot for tabloids. But actually, it's Germany that has Europe's biggest tabloid, Bild, which means picture. With a daily readership of 11.5 million, Bild has enormous influence, and politicians know it's the best way to reach the masses. But its tabloid character isn't for everyone, as Deutsche Welle's Alexa Dwolson found out at one of Berlin's markets.
Simple language, sensational news, emotions, sex.
Extra, extra, read all about it, extra.
Do you read Bild?
Oh no, I don't read it.
Why?
Es ist alles übertrieben.
Everything's exaggerated, out of proportion.
It's about power and position. Bild can make a hero or a villain out of someone in a single day.
Big headlines, lots of pictures, nude women. It's a low-class newspaper.
Bild is very superficial. People just think in the paper slogans and don't realize they're being manipulated.
Do you read Bild?
Gottes Willen, nein!
God forbid no, says this woman. And according to a young man distributing human rights brochures, most of Bild's content is meaningless. Nevertheless,
I think it's so successful because it's so easy to read, because there's a naked woman in the front. They always searching in personal lives of celebrities, and that's interesting.
There's nothing in it, only a lie. Yeah, and tomorrow we write another one.
Not for you.
Nee, not for me.
Well, this is funny. I haven't found a single person who says they read Bild Zeitung, the Bild newspaper, but now I'm at the kiosk right at this market, and it looks like Bild is sold out.
Extra, extra, read all about it, extra.
Bild newspaper was founded in 1952 by the publishing magnate Axel Springer. With headquarters in Hamburg, the paper is preparing a move to the German capital. According to Nikolaus Fest, Bild's culture editor, the paper has remained true to its original mission statement.
That means, first, easy to read, easy to understand. Secondly, affordable for everybody. And thirdly, a clear stance very close to the reader. That means Bild must be their lawyer, their advisor, their friend. Today, most tabloids define themselves probably in a similar way. But 55 years ago, this was a very different and new approach.
With a daily circulation of almost 3.5 million and a price of 50 cents, Bild offers its readers the predictable tabloid cocktail.
What they expect is a critical and especially entertaining summary on what's important in the world of sports, business, politics, etc.
And that etc. can be summed up in three words, mostly nude women. Hard to miss when they're on the front page, and a few others too. But Fest doesn't think it's sexist.
No, first of all, I think the front page girl has as much to do with sexism like similar covers of women, beauty, or general interest magazines. That is, it has absolutely nothing to do with it. Every second ad for perfumes or jeans shows more naked flesh than we do.
Making a big distinction. Most of the beauty magazines don't show topless women, or bottomless for that matter.
No, but if you look at general interest magazine in Germany like Stern or Spiegel, I think nudity, you know, is much more an everyday aspect of life than it used to be.
No surprise, then, that 60% of Bild's readers are men. Karsten Goldbeck, a media analyst at Berlin's Free University, sees a paradox in Germany's tolerance of Bild's flesh display.
It is a contradiction that despite the women's movement, this newspaper is still so successful, even with its portrayal of women as sex objects. But that's Bild's trademark. It's what people associate with Yellow Press, so I don't think its popularity will wane. The tabloid mixture of sex and sensationalism is based on typical mechanisms of pop culture: exaggeration, taboo breaking, a lot of play on words. And many people simply enjoy it without taking it too seriously. Let's face it, they don't buy Bild for political correctness.
Or for factual accuracy, it seems. A little over 3 years ago, Stefan Niggemeier created an online watchdog to highlight Bild's many mistakes. The so-called watch blog has won many prizes, including the Grimme, Germany's most prestigious online award for journalism. Bild's errors are posted at bildblog.de, with a little help from the many readers who send in emails.
We get several dozen a day, often, which is really useful. It's the experts who write to us, say, look, I'm a doctor, I've read this article, I know it's totally wrong. Or sometimes it's even the people who Bild wrote about and point out, oh, actually, I didn't say that at all.
So this means that more people perhaps read Bild than are willing to admit?
It's one of those things, no one admits that they read Bild, but everyone does it. So it's typical.
So much for the funny part.
The reason why we started Bildblog is because of mistakes that don't just happen. Bild does it on purpose. If mistakes just happen, of course they could correct it. But there is not even a culture of corrections in the German media. All newspapers are really reluctant to correct their mistakes, and Bild's particularly bad at it, because the truth of a story isn't important to Bild. The most important thing to Bild is this a good story? Will it sell? Will people want to read it? Not, is it true?
Yeah, we would call that hype.
Oh, it's more than hype. It's really making decisions based on something other than the correct story. If a story sounds more interesting if you tell it sort of not the right way, my experience is that Bild doesn't hesitate to do that.
Equally worrying to Stefan Niggemeier is Bild's tendency to feed into people's fears and prejudices, such as xenophobia. Perhaps Bild underestimates its readers' intelligence. So how can a newspaper be inaccurate, influential, and so preoccupied with young women's bodies all at the same time?
Extra, extra, read all about it, extra.
Alexa Dvorsen, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
Now, Bild had ambitious plans to expand in neighboring France, but a few weeks ago, the publishing house Axel Springer decided to shelve its plans to develop France's biggest newspaper and also the country's first tabloid. France does have weekly tabloid magazines such as Paris Match or Gala, but not a daily tabloid newspaper. RFI's Anis de Broglie reports.
I've been looking for tabloids all over Paris, but have not been able to find one single shop that sells tabloids. But I think I have to give this last shop a chance and then see if this one sells tabloids. I'm going to ask the shopkeeper if he sells tabloids. Bonjour, madame. Est-ce que vous vendez des tabloïds?
No.
So, as you heard, the person in the shop said no. Nowhere in France can you buy tabloids. The French prefer reading the weekly magazines that could be called tabloidish. The French call them magazine people because they have pictures and news about celebrities, where they go for their summer breaks, which celebrity is in love with whom, which celebrity divorced whom, and so on. Nowadays, when you walk in the French capital, you can see the Parisian kiosks, those cylindrical shops that sell newspapers and magazines. They are all covered with huge posters of front pages of tabloidish magazines like Voici, Gala, Closer. But these are all weekly editions. There are no daily editions. Pierre Albert is a media historian, and he says the first tabloid in the world was launched in France.
C'est en France que va naître le premier tabloïd.
The first tabloid was born in France in 1863. It was called Le Petit Journal. It was the size of a, nowadays, what we would call a normal tabloid in the UK, something like 43 centimeters by 30. Le Petit Journal was very popular because it contained only information related to entertainment. It carried no political news at all and cost only a fifth of mainstream newspapers. Only the rich could afford those expensive hard news publications, which were available only on subscription. The masses liked Le Petit Journal because you could buy it without a subscription. It was so popular, in fact, that it became the first newspaper in the world to sell over a million copies. But once it became very popular, it started a slow downward slide. The more it was successful, the bigger it grew in size, the less popular it became. It finally ended up by losing many readers and had to shut down in 1944.
Media historian Pierre Albert in Paris. There are more magazines in France than anywhere else, and every year a few new tabloidish magazines are launched, and they all die quickly. Stéphane Aitaillon is the editor of Closer, a weekly magazine that also exists in the UK. He says the French are not yet ready for a daily tabloid.
I think there are still cultural differences between the German people and British and the French people. People here, they still think that they are a bit embarrassed to buy those magazines, even if it has changed for the last few years, but it's still, they don't say that they buy those magazines. And there are also differences in the advertising market. Here in France, the advertising market, they don't like those magazines, they don't like those newspapers, so you can wait maybe for 3 years, even if you are a big success, you can wait for them to buy your pages, because they are more focused on their image, whereas in Great Britain or Germany, they are more focused on their sales. They want to sell. And there's another reason, I think, is about the private life. Private life laws are much, much harder in France than anywhere in the world. Here, every week, all the year, the celebrities sue the magazines. And even if it's proved that maybe a couple is together, they will sue you and they will win every time. And they will earn a lot of money thanks to your magazine. In Great Britain, since Closer have been launched, they haven't been sued once. In Great Britain, you don't do that. Celebrities don't sue you.
Indeed, you need patience to run such magazines. Closer and Gala, two such weekly magazines, for example, made losses for more than 3 years before they could see their first profits. For Network Europe in Paris, I'm Anastasia Proy.
And that's almost all we have time for this week on Network Europe. But before we go, here are the winners of the August quiz. Adeline Bonnet from Rhodes, France. Kay Rani from Hyderabad, India. Kelvin Lee from Johor, Malaysia. Anthony Binkowski from Ottawa, Canada. And Nisrin Adel from Ohio, USA. We asked you which three films by Swedish director Ingmar Bergman won the Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. And the answer is The Virgin Spring, Through a Glass Darkly, and Fanny and Alexander. We'll be back next week with a new quiz question and our colleagues from RFI in Paris. In the meantime, I'll leave you with Jean-Michel Jarre and more gossip. On behalf of the entire Network Europe team, I'm Barbara Gruber saying thanks for tuning in.